This is HPR episode 2225 entitled, Fosdem 2017K, Level 2 Stands 10 to 19, and is part of the series, Interviews. It is hosted by Ken Forlan, and is about 59 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Ken interviews the projects in the K building Level 2 at Stands 10 to 19.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by AnHonestHost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everybody, I'm at the Open Smart Grid platform and I'm talking to...
Sonny Jansen.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine, how are you?
You're a new project here to Fosdem this year. Can you tell us, give me an idea of what Open Smart Grid is and what you're trying to do with it?
Open Smart Grid is essentially an IoT gateway to control a lot of devices. And we use it for our own operation within Alliander, a Dutch grid utility company.
So you're the people who maintain the wires and the pylons and bring power into our homes.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
The power distribution part. So we don't do production, we do power distribution.
Yeah.
And to do that, we need a lot of control, a lot of devices, like grid automation, smart meters, but also public lighting for municipalities.
Yeah.
And that's where the project started. Municipalities wanted to have more control over their streetlight switching schedules.
Yep.
So we're going to replace ripple control technology with the Open Smart Grid platform and a lot of devices in the field, which give municipalities more control over their own switching scheme.
What was the ripple control?
Ripple control is basically a technology where pulses sent over the grid. Over the 50 hertz grid, and then a lot of devices in the grid pick up that signal, and then they know I have to switch or I have to set a different tariff, etc.
Oh, okay.
So it's pretty old school technology, and it's pretty one way and not so sophisticated.
So everything is just listening to the power grid fluctuations and then do something based on that.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between that and the Open Smart Grid platform? How does presumably it's two-way communication then?
Yeah, with the Open Smart Grid platform, we're going to build in modems into the devices.
Yeah.
And that modem and that device is connected to the Open Smart Grid platform. And the Open Smart Grid platform acts as a gateway between the applications and all those devices. So,
how does it physically do the communication back? Also over the grid?
No, it's a TCP/IP over a separate telecom network.
Okay. So now... But that's going to give you an overhead, like every street light's going to need to have some sort of communication device?
Well, the idea is to switch a whole bunch of street lights at once.
So you're not going down to street light level, you're going to street level, for example.
Yeah, that's what we're offering municipalities nowadays as well, but now it's built on the ripple control technology.
Okay. And so what's the benefit for you? You're a like power distribution network. What's the benefit for you in doing this?
Well, we want to make it open source, so otherwise others can join the development. Because I think there are a lot of organizations who have to manage a lot of devices.
Yeah.
And I think the Open Smart Grid platform can help with them. And by making it open source, we also try to stimulate innovation and work together with others.
Are you coming up with your own technology, or are you using any of the standards and that you've had before?
In the protocol terms, we use the standards used in our smart grid field. So most of them are IEC standards.
Yeah.
But we try to use other standards as well in the more technology sphere.
So it's not an invented here thing. If there's a standard already available, you'll incorporate that.
Yeah. Because then it gives us more market choice to select more. We have more choice in selecting devices. Yeah.
Okay, well, as we were talking earlier, I was bringing up the fact that everybody in Europe is going to have a smart meter put into their homes. I wonder, could you give me what's the idea behind the reasoning of that, and will they also be controlled by Open Smart Grid?
Last year we added the smart metering domain. So if people listening who have millions of smart meters, they can use this Open Smart Grid platform to control them all.
Okay. So is there anything else that you want to talk to me about, or anything? What are you hoping to achieve here by coming to FOSDEM?
We hope to get more spread the word about the Open Smart Grid platform, and especially organizations with a lot of devices who have struggling with managing them all and that kind of stuff. I hope that they join the Open Smart Grid platform development.
This would be also useful for somebody who, a large factory or things like that, or that if you buy components that are Open Smart Grid compatible, that you could also use that in a smaller scale rather than like nationwide like you have.
Yeah, you could use it for a smaller scale, but that's a little bit overkill. Because security is really a thing since we're a utility.
Yeah.
So you lock up almost everything. So it takes you quite some time to develop stuff and make it work.
Yeah.
So for a smaller scale like factories, it could be some overkill.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about a large scale, then it could be very interesting to make that investment.
Okay. When I was doing the research for this here, I was a bit surprised to see that a big, what I would call a traditional Dutch company, would be involved in open source. Can you tell me how did that happen? Who was able to influence the organization? Was it a hard sell? Was it an easy sell? Was it, maybe you can't say too much about it, but...
No, it was me.
It was you.
I was already a big fan of open source before I joined Aleander.
Yeah.
So then at a certain point I thought, well, let's start to do some evangelism.
Yeah.
So I gave presentations to a lot of guys, and then I came across the Open Smart Grid platform. So I said to the colleagues, hey, I can find it on GitHub, so how open is open? So, and then they said to me, oh, some of you need to help us.
Yeah.
What is open source? Yeah, so how does it work? Yeah, and then we went to OSCON.
Yeah.
And then they thought, yeah, well, this is it. Open source is the way to go.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm pushing, because we're also a utility company owned by the public, by the government. So I think this is also a way to give back to the societies, to our investment. Yeah. But it takes a lot of talking, and not every utility is very into open source right now, but it's getting there. But if you like to get more in contact with us, feel free to email us or fire a GitHub issue.
Cool. Thank you very much. Thanks for taking the time. Hello, everybody. I'm here at the Pearl booth meeting up with...
Mark Keating.
Wendy van Dijk.
Curtis Poe.
This is like deja vu. It's just like... Over a year, I was walking past the booth and we were talking to all of you guys. So what has happened in the last year in the Pearl community?
Curtis has his amazing game out. Pearl 6 gets better and better. What else you can do?
We have Camellia Butterfly Stuffed Toys. It's completely new and they're awesome.
For us, it's just mostly been putting our head down and picking up contracts, doing more Pearl development for folks, and it's just amazing some of the stuff we're doing, having a blast with it.
And how is migration to Pearl 6? Do you think that's affecting Pearl 5 at all?
Well, just to clarify, it's not a migration. A lot of people think because 6 is in the name that it's a version number. And Perl 5 and Perl 6 are actually separate languages, the way C-sharp and Java are separate languages, even though they're very related. I think Perl 6 has actually been doing a good job of bringing attention back to Perl in general, and it's been very positive. Everyone who's been looking at Perl 6, when I give talks about it, they're really excited. I mean, they love the sorts of things which are in there. And unlike a lot of other languages, where there's this one thing that you want, everyone seems to have something different in Perl 6 that they really want. And it's been a lot of fun, and it's really been helping to bring some of the excitement back. I love it.
Excellent stuff. So what can I look forward to this year?
Lots of Perl 6 books. This is the year of the Perl 6 books. We already have one in print. Yeah. And there's another one in print coming next month. And both of them, one of them at O'Reilly, one of them is self-published. There will be at least 3 more at O'Reilly. And one other publisher will also do at least one book. So this year we'll see 6 different Perl 6 books. It's appropriate. 6, 6. Nice.
And so is there going to be any talks here at FOSDEM being given?
There's a whole room tomorrow of Perl talks. So it's back-to-back talks all day in the Perl Dev room.
On Sunday we will have 13 talks in a row.
Yeah. Okay. All those will be available on the FOSDEM website, which you're going to have to search for yourself because you can't possibly put links to every different project. But
yes, you can. You lazy bum.
And our company, we're looking at releasing an MMORPG, a universe actually, written in Perl, Perl 5 specifically. And we've been having a lot of fun. We'll be giving a talk about that tomorrow, in fact, at the request of the organizers.
I have just been giving a flyer about that, which looks amazingly cool. Are all these graphics done within Perl 6?
No, the game itself is written in Perl 5. Yeah. Most of the graphics, I believe, are Blender, I think. Yeah. Well, that depends. That's the person who's doing the 3D art. Our graphic designer, I actually don't know what tools she's using.
Okay. Cool. Well, congratulations and have a good show this year.
Thank you. You too.
Hi, I'm at the Koala booth and I'm talking to
Lasse Schumann.
And I'm also talking to
Sebastian Lattert.
Okay guys, remind everybody again what Koala.io is.
So Koala is a tool for linting and fixing code in all programming languages. That means I can take code in any programming language, more or less, and I can apply Koala to it, and I get information about what could be potentially wrong with my source code without having to worry about 5,000 different tools for all those languages for different aspects of my source code.
And how are you going to maintain that for all the different languages as they go on?
So the code analysis from Koala at the moment mainly consists out of wrappers around existing tools. So one of the main tasks that Koala does is it organizes a fleet of, I think, over 100 tools to work for you without you having to worry about all of them. And secondly, Koala has native algorithms and we design them to work on any programming language. So you would essentially provide a small definition for a programming language and that algorithm would, with that information, work on that language. Because for some, especially the simpler things, there is absolutely no need to rewrite that analysis for every language again and again, especially spacing. Like, that's totally easy.
Is this something that can be integrated into a continuous workflow or an agile programming development workflow?
And I think that's what you want to talk about.
Yes, that is.
That's how we started our future project. It's called GitMate. So with GitMate, our general idea is to improve the Git workflow, simplify the Git workflow of developers. And the idea originated from Koala. Like, the first approach was to take Koala and integrate it seamlessly into a Git workflow, like having the comments right where a human commenter, a human reviewer would comment as well. And from there on, we started thinking about other stuff, how you can improve the Git workflow as well, like, for example, with general repository management, or also with finding bugs in an early stage. So we're currently working on that. And we also use FOSDEM to communicate with other developers of the FOSDEM, trying to find out what they like most and how we can help them simplifying the Git workflow.
So as you check into Git, it would kick off Koala, and then you get a report back on quality of your code.
As soon as you do the pull request, it would check in Koala, but it wouldn't be labeled as Koala, but as GitMate, though. But it will use the Koala engine to do the analysis.
Okay, and completely transparent of what programming language.
Yeah, the same as Koala, yeah.
Oh, excellent, excellent. And are there going to be any talks here at FOSDEM this year, or are you going to be stuck in the booth?
We're going to be stuck in the booth. Possibly there will be a talk we don't know of. There have been in the past.
Yeah. But you're just booth minions.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. I'll let you go back to it. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Hi, I'm at the Linux from Scratch booth, and I'm talking to
Julien Lepilaire.
Hi, and can you tell us what Linux from Scratch is?
Linux from Scratch is a book to learn how to build a Linux system from nothing.
So you have the actual source code, you build the source code. That's how it is.
Yes, you download the source code of all the programs you need, and you compile everything. And once you finish all the book, you have a running Linux system.
You're up to the bash command, basically.
Yes. Actually, there are two books. The first book is only to build the first Linux system that is very minimal. The most advanced program you will have is Vim. And then there's a second book called Beyond Linux from Scratch that will teach you everything there is to know to have a real Linux system with Xorg and any program you will need.
So you're physically selling books here on the booth, and they're not that thick. Is it possible, would you recommend people physically type in from the book or copy and paste in from a terminal?
It's still better to copy paste because some comments are very long and you can easily make mistakes that don't show up immediately. So sometimes if you make a mistake at the beginning, you only find them at the end of the book. So you should still copy paste the comment from the internet.
Okay, so what's new in the book this year?
So every version there are new versions of programs.
I see here systemd is in, so you will be compiling systemd, I guess, this time.
Yes, but it was still the time, it was the case last year too.
Okay, yeah.
So it's not really new. There's a systemd and a sysv init version.
Okay.
Since last year, they have merged both in the same repository for better maintenance.
Yep.
But apart from that, there's nothing really new.
Okay, you're just keeping up with the latest and greatest.
Yes, all the software is always up to date.
And now that's an interesting point, because you two are now running two laptops with Linux from Scratch, I presume.
I don't think so.
Oh, the shame. They are running, because this is radio, nobody will be able to tell. Yes, they're running two laptops with Linux from Scratch. How do you keep up to date with your Linux from Scratch version, or is that not the intention?
So there's nothing really that helps you having... usually when you build your Linux from Scratch system, it's a one-shot process and you can't really update anything.
Yeah.
Especially the base system is very hard to update. But there are some tips to build package managers or to have your own package manager so you can still update your packages.
Okay, very good. Why did you get involved in the project?
So first I wanted to learn more about how Linux is done, and I wanted to build my own system. I wanted to have a system that is really that is exactly what I wanted, but it takes a lot of time, and it was very very enjoyable to have my own system that reacts exactly as I wanted it to. But now I don't have that much time, so I don't have an LFS system anymore.
Oh dear. To me, it's a bit like traveling around the world. It's something you want to do once. It takes a lot of time, but you're glad you've done it.
Yes. I've been updating my LFS system for 2 years, so it's doable. But at some point, you have to accept that you won't have all that time. It takes a lot of time, and you will want to do something else at some point.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck with the rest of the show. Hi, I'm at the Google booth, and I'm talking to
Joshua Simmons with the Google Open Source Programs Office.
So you have two sides of the table here. Can you tell me what they're about?
Absolutely. So we have two sides of the table. One is Google Summer of Code. The other is Google Codin. Google Summer of Code is our program to get university students involved with open source software. Google Codin is targeted at students aged 13 to 17. So Google Summer of Code works this way. There are about 178 projects that participated last year. And some of those projects are like the Python Software Foundation, who are an umbrella for lots of other projects. What they do is they list project ideas, and students then apply to work on those project ideas. The students who get accepted to the program then spend 3 months with the help of a mentor, and they work on those projects. And we pay them a stipend so that they can focus on that work rather than having to take a summer job. Google Codin is a little different because it's for a younger age. It's much smaller. We had about 17 organizations who participated this last year, and it's a contest, so there's no money, but we do give students swag, and the ones who are picked at the end of the contest, two students per project, are chosen as grand prize winners, and we give them a trip to San Francisco and Mountain View. Exactly, all expenses paid, and we show them a good time, and they get to meet Google engineers and learn more about it.
Basically promoting software. Exactly. So how did you get involved in this project? Did you volunteer for it?
So I came in through the side door. I'm a web developer myself, and I worked as a community manager in a past life. So I joined the Open Source Programs Office in the last year. And so I help as part of the 5-person outreach team running Google Codin, Google Summer of Code, and my task in particular is to run the Google open source blog.
Okay, so that's you.
That's me, yes. Yes.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, pleasure.
So why come to FOSDEM?
FOSDEM is the largest FOSS event that we attend every year. And it's the fact that it's a free to the public event means that we get to talk to a lot more students than we might find at other events. A lot of open source events are more expensive, frankly. And so we find the people who we really need to talk to, not just the students, but also a lot of project maintainers are here. And it's really critical for us to talk to both of those groups, because we want the project maintainers to apply to be a part of the programs. We want the students to apply to work for those projects.
So any new? So when does this start happening? When do we need to apply if I was a project or if I'm a student?
So we just concluded Google Codin. Google Codin ended January 16th, I believe. We announced our grand prize winners a week ago. So Google Codin will start again in about November of next year, usually after the American Thanksgiving holiday, about that time. Google Summer of Code is ramping up right now. So applications for organizations and projects that want to apply are open till Thursday, February 9th. Yep. So anyone who's interested should look at that and apply now. students should look to apply. Well, they should start watching now, because we're going to be announcing the organizations and projects that will be a part of that in the coming weeks. And I don't have the specific dates available to me in the moment, but that generally runs from students begin usually applying around April, and then it runs through May, June, July, and August.
Do you have anything equivalent for the Southern Hemisphere?
We don't. We're a small team, and the challenge that we have is that the organizations that apply to this, you know, they need to have a point of contact to run their program from their side, and they also need mentors for each of the students, two mentors per student. So we try not to burn them out, because it's a bit of a commitment for them. So in an ideal world, we would run it, you know, a summer and winter of code, so that both hemispheres could participate equally. But that's just not where we're at right now.
Then it's a winter of code, I guess. Okay, thank you very much for. Did I miss anything? Or? Okay. Do you happen to know some background about the winners, especially the Google, the two winners, the projects that won?
So I don't have that in front of me, but I know that they came from a number of different countries around the world, and that's one of the things that's really exciting about both of these programs, is they're entirely global. So, you know, some of these, often when we bring them to the States, it's often their first time in the U.S., and sometimes it's their first time in a big city, so they get to see San Francisco, and you get to see the stars in their eyes.
Awesome. Well done. Thank you very much. Links to all this will be in the show notes, and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, I'm at the Ultimaker booth, and I'm talking to...
My name is Rodney Becker.
Hi, and can you tell me what Ultimaker is?
Ultimaker is a 3D printing manufacturer based in Geldermalsen in the Netherlands. We're originally an open source company focusing on building an accessible 3D printer made for the market and for the part use.
And when you say open source, how much is open source?
We started off as an open source company because of the fact that the founders they didn't have really the intention to start up a company, so they made it open source to make it accessible for a large community.
Yeah.
And that's the whole reason that we made it open source, and also to get some feedback from the outside world, as it may.
So I can go to your website, I can download the technical drones.
Yeah, the technical drones, everything. Technical and software-wise, you can find on online.
So, where's the business model?
The business model is based in the whole package, because we make software. We have a slicer called Cura. We came up with Cura, and the slicer in combination with the printer, it provides the whole experience of the ultimate 3D printing experience, as it may.
And a slicer is, they explain to people what a slicer is.
A slicer is a program that generates G-code that makes it understandable for the printer. So you have a design made in AutoCAD or SolidWorks or something like that. And you can transform that or to load that into Cura, our slicer, and it makes it understandable for the printer in what layers, the layer thickness, the speed, and the type of material you would like to print.
Okay, can you basically describe what sort of products you have available?
We have a wide variety of different printers, so Cura, but it's free software. And we provide every service on every service level that you might need to get the best result you need.
So on your thing here, you say professional 3D printing. So I'm guessing you're not aiming at the $150 Chinese knockoff market.
Yeah, well, with all due respect to the Chinese market, we make a printer that is can be used professionally, and our slogan is professional 3D printing make accessible. So it says it all. The knockoff versions of 3D printers, and also the knockoff Ultimakers, they don't provide the much needed quality that you might need within your 3D printing process.
Do you also provide then a third-party support and maintenance engineers to go around to factories or hospitals that will be using this technology?
We have a department focusing on that. So the usability of 3D printing in general, firstly, but secondly also looking at partnerships to provide the necessary input for instance the automotive or the aerospace sector, and really shifting away from more the around the house use, as it may, towards a more industrializing process.
It's becoming a lot more accepted in industry now to have 3D printing process as part of your. Can you take me through some of the stuff that's on your table that you managed to print off?
You mean the printers itself, or
what we're looking at, and some of the stuff you printed?
Okay, yeah. Well, we have some examples of the things you can print with the printer. But also our newest printer, that's the Ultimaker 3. It has the possibility to have two axes for different materials, so dual axis. And software-wise and technical-wise, it's a much improved printer in comparison with the old ones. But also the old ones, we made some upgrades for that to make it more up to standard in the use that you might need as either a home printer or an industrial printer.
They seem quite fast.
It is, but it's not. We're still looking into getting things done faster. But we experienced that our customers find that quality is the main drive to buy a printer and to buy an Ultimaker. So that's why we always focus on quality.
Yeah.
So getting the print you're looking for in order to make it faster.
Do you also work with businesses that are new to 3D printing in order to help them? Do you provide courses and stuff like that to help them get up to speed with how to use it in their environments?
Well, the fun thing is that we get user cases from the industry itself. So we as a company sometimes get surprised by a company who already uses 3D printing in their production process. And we always enjoy hearing those kind of stories because it for us is motivating to stay innovative and to make a process that is and to deliver a product that is up to standard and what is the public is
people that it's selling itself.
Yeah.
What's the new stuff that's coming up this year?
Well, we are looking for a printer who is an upgrade from the 3. We just released the 3. And still looking into ways to get a better fit towards the industry branch. So maybe looking into to more access for the materials, but also thinking about improving the spaces within the printer or to make it more like an industrial setup.
Yeah, very good. Okay. Well, was there anything I missed?
That we are still trying to provide the necessary quality products for the people. That's the whole meaning and reason that we do this.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
I was just saying it's the company I most want to work for. So
okay.
This is no secret.
Well, you have my business card. So
there you go. Yes. Okay. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm at the Sofa booth and I'm talking to.
My name is Hugo Talbot.
And can you tell me what Sofa is and what you're doing?
Yes, Sofa is actually a library focusing on physics simulation. And we use it's existing for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And we are especially using physics simulation for medical application.
And when you say physics, you're not talking in the real world, you're talking about computer animation.
Yeah, so we are talking about, when I say physics, it's more about, you know, how does the human body behaves, what are the physical phenomenon taking place there, and for example, that's how does an organ deforms, how does, you know, the temperature in the human body evolve, that kind of physics that we are simulating.
Okay, and why are you here?
So I'm here because we discovered FOSDEM. I discovered FOSDEM the last year, I would say, something like that. And SOFA is open source, and we thought, okay, we are open source. We need to be in the open source places, and that's actually a quite amazing place for, you know, meeting people. There is a huge interest of people just with a huge curiosity. So that's a very good discovery and a very good meeting for us.
So it's a library, so you're writing an application for something, then you can call this. What's it written in and what do I need to get it running?
So yeah, anyone can actually start writing his own application. So far, it's the open source code is a core that allows you then to do anything you want. If you want to start your own application, you will maybe develop your own plugin, your own module. You can set the license you want to this code. It can be proprietary or open. And the idea is, what do you need to do? Either you can code a little bit of C++ in it and create new models, new physical law and so on, or you can also directly use what is already existing, for example by using XML or Python scripts and describe your simulation and run it straight away.
So can you describe on this a typical use case that might be on the screen here?
Yeah, so a typical example can be, so here we have the simulation of the temperature evolution in the human body. That's here for curing some kind of tumors. There is tumors in an organ,
yeah.
And we want to cure it, but to know how exactly to do that, we are taking the patient data,
yeah.
We are analyzing the data,
yeah.
And then we are running different kind of simulations to know what would be the best strategy to treat this specific patient. So we can, for example, with simulation, design new tools to help the surgeon to make the right choice for the right patient for the surgery. So that's the kind of example that you can do with simulation.
Can you use this for training purposes?
Yeah, exactly. So there is that has been actually the main and the first purpose of the simulation. It was for training, just like for in aeronautics simulation, a lot of pilots are training virtually. So just like in medicine here, medical doctors, medical students could also train on virtual simulation, and that's one of the, I would say, yeah, two or three main purposes of simulation in the field.
And how did you start?
So it started actually a long time ago. It's a project from researchers from several different research centers, mainly INRIA, which is a French national research institute in computer science. And yeah, it was the original idea was to have a common base of code, to share between researchers with an open source license. And yeah, that's we can see sometimes some organs, some live demo of.
Here I'm seeing what looks like a video, and then over that there's like a computer mesh.
Yeah. So that's actually the video of intraoperative video. That's really for a specific patient.
Yeah.
That's his liver. And on top of that, we are adding information that comes from the simulation, and we are doing actually augmented reality with that kind of tool. So we are helping the surgeon during the operation.
Okay.
You mentioned training. We mentioned help to plan the operation. That's the third one, actually. That's guidance. During the operation, guide the surgeon to reach his goal.
Yeah. In this instance, they're taking a 2D image, and then as it rotates around, you can see it like I presume it's a growth or something that they're trying to remove in three dimensions. So that really helps give you an idea where it is.
Exactly. Yeah. We are extracting information from this video, which is 2D. We are extracting as much information as we can so that we then give information to our 3D physical model, which is here a mechanical model.
Yeah.
And from this mechanical model, then we give back information, for example, where the tumor is located or where the blood vessels are located, so that the surgeon can, during the operation, take the right decision.
Absolutely awesome stuff. But presumably you wouldn't be limited to medical applications. This could be used somewhere else. I don't know, to be widgets in a widget factory or something.
Exactly. That's a question of history. From the very beginning, we applied that to the medical field, because a lot of research projects were around medical applications. But finally, it could be applied to any kind of simulation. It could be simulation for automotive, automobile or stuff like that. Could be for building. It transfer
mining or something. Who knows? Yeah.
There is definitely a lot of applications. And for example, one of the recent applications we discovered is a German startup that was using SOFA, and we didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
We knew that when we created a consortium 1 year ago, and we discovered that there was a German startup using SOFA for industrial robotics. So something not related at all with any kind of application in medicine. So that's the kind of example that we discover in the community. Yeah.
Excellent. Anything else that is coming up this year that you want to tell us about?
So yeah, this year, I mean, that's really, we are from the last year and the year that's gonna come, so 2017, that's gonna be really the start of this consortium that we are building around the software. Yep. And the idea is to really gather as many people interested in this project, to get new achievements from researchers, from companies, from startups that are working around SOFA. So we hope to to gather as many partners as possible around the platform.
And it's sofa-framework.org, link will be in the show notes. Okay, thank you. Did we miss anything?
No, perfect.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for taking the time and good luck with the rest of the show. Hi, I'm at the MuseScore booth and I'm talking to...
You're talking to Nicolas Fromont.
And did I mispronounce the name of the project?
The name of the project is MuseScore. I think you were right.
Yeah, okay, well done. Well done, me. So can you tell me what it is and what it does?
So MuseScore is a free software to create sheet music, music notation. It's a WYSIWYG software, meaning you see exactly what you are doing, and when you will print the sheet, it will be exactly what you see on the screen. You can enter the notes with the keyboard, the mouse, or MIDI keyboard that is plugged to the computer. People use it in many different ways. People compose with it, arrange scores. They use it for orchestra, but they would use it for concert band, for choir, or only for single instrument and to learn the piano, for example, those type of things.
And is it open source? Is
it's entirely open source. It's under GPLD2 and it's made on C++ and Qt. And it's available on GitHub, github.com/MuseScore, and you can get the source and contribute there.
So it's an application that you run on your system locally?
Exactly. It's a desktop application for Linux, any kind of Linux, for FreeBSD as well, and for Mac and Windows.
Okay, very good. And I think that pretty much explains it, doesn't it?
Exactly. So you can enter notes and you can play the notes as well, and then you can print them. If there is two things that I could add is that on top of that, a lot of our users, so it's a very popular project. We have 5,000 people downloading the software on Mac and Windows every day. So that's quite a lot of people. And these people, they like to share the score on our website. So we have a big database of scores made by the community. And these scores are in an editable format, which is something pretty unique. Meaning, if someone made it for piano and you want to play it with a trumpet, you can get the score, open it in MuseScore, and then edit it to sound like a trumpet and be more suitable for you. Or you can make it easier for your students, for example, to play a certain song they really want to play.
Is that Creative Commons stuff then, or what's
most of the thing is composition, and people can choose how they put the license. So we support public domain, Creative Commons Zero, several Creative Commons flavor, and also all right reserved. So there is all kind of content on there. Regarding this particular, since you asked me about public domain and Creative Commons, we are working on a project to digitize, and I mean really digitize, scores, which are currently only in PDF. There is a big website called eimslp.org, which contains, I think, 6 million pages of scores of music, but only in PDF. And with the PDF, well, you can't listen to it, you can't loop it, you can't learn it, you can't click on a note and see which note it is. So we want to digitize this with the help of our community. So we will launch a campaign in order to digitize scores. We call this project OpenScore, and there will be a talk here about this.
Okay, and so you're going to have a talk. Are you launching it? Is that site already available?
No, it's not yet available. It will be available in probably in April. And okay. I guess you will learn about it. I mean, we will try to make a lot of noise about it, of course. So.
Badoomch. Anything else that happened last year and coming up this year?
One thing interesting is that we were part of Google Summer of Code last year. It's a cool I feel it's a cool project. I know it's by Google, but I like it a lot. We are a very small community of developers. We are four core developers and then a couple of tens people trying to help us, and the Google Smart Code project has bring us a lot of students that helps the development. So yeah, it's a cool stuff. What will come next is version 2.1 of MuseCore, and we are working on a big release, MuseCore 3, but that will be for next year somewhere, hopefully, or in 2 years. But it will have a lot more nice features, and one of that people expect a lot is anti-collision. So, yeah.
What's that?
Anti-collision is the fact that when you enter a particular marking on the score, it doesn't collide with other elements.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for taking the time. Did we cover it?
No, I'm fine. Thank you. It was great to be interviewed by you. So thank you very much.
No problem. Hi, I'm at the Matrix booth and I'm talking to
Matthew Hodgson. I'm the tech co-founder of Matrix.
So tell us, what is Matrix?
So Matrix is an open standard for interoperable decentralized communication. So the idea is to try to provide a neutral fabric for communication on the web, which links together all of the different silos out there today which can't talk to one another. So that's making WhatsApp, talk to Skype, talk to Facebook, talk to IRC, talk to XMPP, talk to the PSTN, and everything in between.
And Matrix does this, does it?
It does most of it. So we've got bridges today through to IRC on Freenode, Mozilla Network, and a whole bunch of others. Plus, you can run your own IRC bridges too. We have Slack, Gitter, Telegram. The community have contributed iMessage and Facebook Messenger. So the dream is really coming true.
So I could use any of these clients to communicate with the other ones within... There's got to be a star next to that.
Yeah, so there's a little catch. At the moment, a lot of the bridges are focused on group chats and rooms. So the idea is that if you have a community which has ended up split between IRC and Slack and Gitter, which is a combination we're seeing way too often, unfortunately, at the moment, then on the Matrix side, you can create a Matrix room and bridge that into the other three ones. So the people on IRC will be able to see and talk to the people, etc., and link it all together. Now, for a one-to-one conversation, that is also supported, for instance, for IRC private messages going through to Matrix and direct messages. And in theory, you should be able to go all the way through from a private message on, say, IRC to a private message on Telegram. And we're just getting to the point of wiring that in now. But it's still, honestly, in development. But patches are very welcome.
Oh, cool. And so I come up with a new service like WhatsApp or something. How would you go about integrating that?
So there are basically three components in the Matrix ecosystem. You have servers or home servers, which store all of your conversation history, and they're kind of like a mail server. And the cool thing about those, by the way, is that if you're running your own server and I'm running my own one, the conversation is completely replicated over both. So no single entity owns or controls that conversation. It's kind of like Git rather than Subversion or CVS or whatever. And basically none of the other chat systems do that. And it's cool because it subversively, aggressively decentralizes everything. I cannot talk to you without decentralizing ownership of that conversation. So those are the servers. Then you have clients, which are pretty boring. Not boring, but they're sort of all the typical chat clients. They look like Slack. They could be a command line thing like WeChat, or they could be a desktop client like Quaternion or NaChat. And then finally, to actually answer your question, you have bridges, which are the application services that link the existing services like WhatsApp or Skype or whatever into the rest of Matrix. And these are basically clients, but on steroids, in that they can impersonate an entire network. So if you just created a new chat system like, I don't know, Wire, for instance, and you wanted to link that into Matrix, then the bridge is actually quite simple because it just needs to talk to Wire, obviously, on one side, and then it's basically a big cluster of Matrix clients on the other side. And the Slack bridge, for instance, is 100 lines of code. And it really is 100 lines of JavaScript, for better or worse, built on top of our Matrix App Service bridge library. And it's designed to make it really, really easy for people to take their favorite protocol and bridge it into the rest of Matrix.
So I've been forced to use lots of applications that I don't necessarily want to use. And I want to use something that comes with a free and open source desktop. Can I then use Matrix to plug in the gaps?
Absolutely. So that's really the classic use case on the bridging side of things. So Matrix itself is a protocol, and it's a software foundation that looks after the protocol. Then there are lots of different apps built on top of it. Riot is the name of the kind of flagship client at the moment, and that's available completely open source, completely Apache licensed, on desktop as an Electron app, on the web, on iOS as a native iOS app, and on Android as a native Android app. Plus, it's available on F-Droid as well as the Google App Store, or Google Play Store, I should say. And that's kind of the classic way in which many people choose to use Matrix, of going and firing up that app, bridging the rooms into Slack or IRC or whatever, and basically using it as a huge decentralized bouncer, but not just for IRC, but all of your conversations. So they're liberated, we say, into Matrix, and you can then use the Matrix APIs against your own home server or someone else's, or you can use the matrix.org one, and you basically get control of your conversations again in an open standard set of APIs.
And I'll be able to log all those and search them, and
I have my history again.
Yeah, you have the history, you have full text search, and we use Postgres and SQLite as the databases by default on it. You basically regain control at last, and we bust open the walls of the walled gardens like WhatsApp and Skype.
So what do I need to run this on?
So the typical server that people use if they're running their own server is Synapse, which is written in Python and Twisted, and it runs anywhere really that can run Python and Twisted. There are Debian deb files published in our repository. People make RPMs. It's in part of the BSD ports process, ports system, and there are really lots of different packages of Synapse. On the client side, it's dead easy because Riot as a web app is just static HTML and JavaScript, so you just get a tarball, expand it, and run it. And on iOS and Android, it's just in the stores. So the easiest way to get up and running is probably to use the default matrix.org server to try it out, and then if you like it, run your own server and have all of your clients connect to that instead.
Would it run on a Raspberry Pi
3? It does run on a Raspberry Pi 2 and 3.
Well, there you go. I think I'm going to terminate this conversation and go try it now. No, I won't. I have more interviews to do. But what has been the cool stuff last year, and what's the cool stuff next year?
Well, almost all of last year was putting in end-to-end encryption, which I haven't mentioned at all yet, actually, but it's one of the most important things that we have here, that because the conversation history is replicated over all of those different servers, if it's not encrypted, that's quite a big attack surface. You're trusting a lot of random servers and sysadmins. Everybody who participates in the room basically will have a copy of it. So if you want any privacy, you have to have end-to-end encryption. And what we did was to implement a new system called Ulm, which is an implementation of the axolotl, now called the double ratchet, that was invented by Open Whisper Systems for use with Signal. And we went and wrote an Apache licensed version of it in C++ 11 with C wrappers on it. And we got it audited by NCC Group, and we actually paid, well, in part funded by the Open Tech Fund, for a public audit to prove that even though we'd written our own crypto, it didn't suck. And indeed, they gave us a very good audit. And that was back in September of last year. And we started the beta in November. And since then, we've been gradually rolling it out across, starting with the official Matrix client SDKs and Riot, which is built on top of them. And we're in late beta now. We just launched a new version this morning for FOSDEM, especially Riot 0.9.7, get it whilst it's hot, which includes the latest fixes to the Ulm ratchet there. And we also created another ratchet called MegOM, which is the group conversation one. So the way it works is that you encrypt per device rather than per user, which is pretty cool. So if you want to blacklist a particular device receiving your messages, you can. And you set up one-to-one channels to those devices via the classic axolotl Ulm ratchet, and then over those channels you share the group encryption session data for the group conversations. So basically, if you have 1,000 people in a room, which we support for the encrypted chat, then you only need to have one-to-one conversations between all of those 1,000 people to set up the group ratchet that then everybody respectively shares, which is a big novelty.
What's a group ratchet?
So a group ratchet is one where I basically I have a ratchet which encrypts the series of...
What's a ratchet?
Okay. That's the easier one. Okay, so a ratchet is an algorithm that generates a series of keys. And just like a mechanical ratchet, it can only go forwards. So it's kind of useful so that you can't revert. If you get a key later on in the sequence, you can't use it to attack the previous conversation you didn't have access to. And a group ratchet is one of those, except it's one which is doing one-to-many rather than one-to-one.
Okay.
So basically everybody in the room has one of these ratchets, and they go and use it to generate the keys for the messages they send. And they send the message once, and everybody else in the room needs to have a copy of that ratchet in order to decrypt it. So the question is, how do you get them a copy of that ratchet? Well, that's how you use the normal signal-style one-to-one stuff. So basically, we've tried to solve the holy grail of group asynchronous encrypted one-to-one communications in a manner better than Signal or WhatsApp or Wire or any of the other systems out there. And hopefully it works. There are still a couple of bugs in the beta right now. Sometimes you can't decrypt messages about 2% of the time, but we're working on it, and it's generally pretty good.
Okay, excellent stuff. Gosh, that's a lot.
Sorry.
No, not sorry. There is no way you can do this in your spare time.
Yep, correct. It's a huge initiative because we're creating a whole ecosystem of interoperable communication. Our history is originally that we were doing proprietary commercial messaging apps for telecoms companies, and we did that for about 10 years. And honestly, it got a bit depressing because why, as an end user, would you install another messaging app that's a silo from your phone operator of all people? So we basically had a choice to either quit or try to do something crazy like Matrix. And we went to our corporate overlords and said, hey, crazy idea, why don't we go open source and non-profit and build Matrix? And they said, well, okay then. And that was 2 years ago. So we're basically being paid as an existing team of about 16 people to go completely off message, create Matrix, try to terraform a whole new industry. And if it exists and it works, it's kind of like the web. No, the actual standard is open and completely flexible for anybody. And it still means that big companies can go and provide hosted services, and they can provide carrier grade deployments or whatever, and it kind of works both for the end user and for the big companies, and hopefully everybody wins.
Who is the big corporate overlord then?
So the corporate overlord is a company called Amdocs, who do billing solutions for telcos primarily. They're 35 years old as of last week, and this is the first time they've done open source, but so far it's been a cautiously positive success, I would say.
Oh, fair fucks to them, really. Oh, well done.
So yeah, I mean, that's basically where Matrix is at. In the coming year, we're getting to the point where we're starting to see spam on the network. So there's going to be...
Then you know you're becoming popular.
Oh yes, yeah, indeed. We welcomed our first spammer a couple of weeks ago in a very... we didn't welcome them particularly with open arms, but it really becomes shows how relevant it is that we need to solve the decentralized reputation problem for spam, and that is basically the same as solving spam for SMTP. But the good news is that we're making up our own protocol, so we can hopefully engineer it in a much better way than email ever could, but that's going to be a huge focus in the coming year. That and threading, because we don't yet have threaded conversations, and that's really important for bridging to email and to message boards and to forums.
You can bridge to email as well?
We can, but it sucks because without threading you just get this big long...
So we
really have to get threading in there. Whatever things are on the horizon. There's so much stuff going on at the moment. A whole new server implementation. So we're moving away from Python to Golang. Yep. So we're just putting the first touches to the first build of Dendrite, which is the name of the Golang server. And this is a highly scalable, horizontally sort of scalable server that uses append-only log-based architecture. So you have lots of different components for different rooms and different presents and all the other different sync, receiving messages, federating. They're all split off into their own separate servers, and they're all glued together by a big decentralized message bus internally, so they can cluster as much as you like, which is very different to Synapse, which is a single monolithic blob of Python, basically. So that's going to be fun.
Wow, you're going to be busy.
Oh yeah, no, this year is going to be kind of make or break for us. If we can fix the spam problem and the scalability stuff, then there's no reason why it can't just explode and replace the phone network, which is basically what we were aiming for.
Okay, awesome. Listen, thank you very much for taking the time, and I really hope you wish you good luck with the FOSDEM and the coming year.
Indeed, thank you very much. It's been great to chat.
No problem.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.